Delegates to the American Library Association, members of the publishing community, members of the 2001 Newbery Committee, to whom I am so grateful, ladies and gentlemen. Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I invoke my valued colleague, San Francisco's own incomparable Peggy Rathman. If she had not already said it to you before me, I would say it now. It takes a village to write my books. I am grateful to my agent, Sheldon Fogelman, to whom my obligations go beyond the contractual. I am grateful to my British publisher at Hodder & Stoughton, Mary Tapissier from London. I am grateful to George Nicholson, once of Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. After the tense and silent summer of 1971, I took a first manuscript to him, hoping for advice. On the following morning, early, George rang up to say, "You may start your second novel." I've just kept going, hoping to have the next book accepted before the last book can be reviewed. I am here because of a colleague who was not nearly such a slow starter as I. She is S.E. Hinton. In the spring of 1973, she was unable to speak to the Indiana Library Association. I was called off the bench and onto the field to pinch hit. I've never left it. That evening began nearly three decades of visits to young readers and their librarians, who always, somehow, can tell me what my next book will be about. I am grateful to librarians, because they are the local representatives of all writers, living and dead. I'm twice grateful to those librarians willing to write grant proposals in their own time, grants for author-in-the-school programs. As a result, I never see a typical school. I see a school where a librarian has moved heaven, earth, and the classroom teachers to bring writers and young readers together. It is always a librarian who fears no parent, because you can communicate with children, or you can fear their parents, but you cannot do both. How much author in the school programs mean to me, because if a living author of anything had entered the classroom when I was in seventh grade, it would have given me permission to dream. Many a better writer has accepted the Newbery Medal over these past 80 years. Many a better writer has been denied it. But no writer ever admired his writing colleagues more than I do, or learned more from them. They are names that should be on the lips of every American parent. Patricia Riley Giff, Katherine Patterson, Paula Danziger, Will Hobbs, Walter Dean Myers, Lois Duncan, Sonia Soanes, M.E. Kerr, Kate DiCamillo, Jerry Spinelli, Cynthia DeFelice, Chris Crutcher, Michael Cadnam, Graham Salisbury, Lois Lowry, Christopher Paul Curtis, Sharon Creech, Judy Bloom, Mark Talbert, Jacqueline Woodson, Paul Zindel, Joan Bauer, Jack Gantos, and many, many more. Their work towers above the ruins of an educational system, public and private, in which literacy has become an elective. And the librarian and the writer may be the only teachers in many young lives. Being a writer never improved anybody's mental health, and so I'm grateful for the companionship and therapy of my colleagues. Only one hard truth beclouds this evening. I am the first writer to meet this moment after the lifetime of Robert Cormier. After his lifetime, but not after his life. I'm here because of another colleague in our writer's village, Harry Mazur. In the fall of 1995, Harry sent forth a decree. He wanted us to write short stories for his new collection, a collection of gun stories. As you know, it became a book called 12 Shots. Now, I haven't personally squeezed off a round since the rifle range at Fort Carson, Colorado, in January of 1957. And I had to wonder in my heart just how many librarians are members of the National Rifle Association, however much you may personally admire Charlton Heston. In fact, I wondered if Harry was slipping, but of course he wasn't. He'd included a postcard to send back saying, "Yes, I'll do you a story," or "No, I won't." And I itched to send that postcard back saying, Dear Harry, I'll give it a shot. Trying to imagine what kind of stories Harry would get, I envisioned a lot of male-dominated, macho-menaced yarns about how I shot a bear and it made a man out of me. In fact, a lot of over-serious stories. So I gave myself an assignment. I'd write a comedy about a female character, just to give Harry's collection some balance. I looked up from my desk, and there in the door stood Grandma Dowdle, with a 12-gauge, double-barreled Winchester shotgun loose in her trigger-happy hand. I called my story Shotgun Cheatham's Last Night Above Ground. Then I ran it past my editor at Dial Books for Young Readers, Cindy Kane. She thought there was a book in it, a gathering of short stories building to a novel. That book became A Long Way from Chicago, which brought me to the Newbery Caldecott dinner of 1999, though farther back in the room. When a book comes that far, the editor says what Cindy did. We'll need another book about Grandma Dowdle, and we'd like it by Thursday. Thus, a year down yonder began to be. Real life is too contrived for fiction. The Delacorte editor of Harry Mazur's 12 Shots has since become my editor at Dial, Laurie Hornick. In their discreet directiveness, Cindy Kane and Laurie Hornick are the best of editors. I thank them and Harry Mazur for this medal. With another Grandma Dowdle book due, I saw I'd made a grave error in a career full of them. I'd let Joey, the narrator of A Long Way from Chicago, grow up. He was in World War II, and so a sequel was out of the question. Happily, Joey's younger sister, Mary Alice, was waiting in the wings. She told a different story. Joey expressed his awe at the power of a mighty grandmother, and perhaps of all women. Mary Alice tells of finding, in an unexpected place, the role model for the rest of her life. Now people ask, was Grandma Dowdle your grandmother? Even librarians ask. We writers aren't given much credit for creativity. Did my grandmother fire off both barrels of a shotgun in her own front room? Did she pour hot glue on the head of a hapless Halloweener? Did she spike the punch at a Daughters of the American Revolution tea? Well, no. When you're a writer, you can give yourself the grandmother you wish you'd had. But the setting for the stories is real. All my settings are real places because I am a product of vanished classrooms where maps still hung, and the necessary study of geography was taught and learned. History was still taught then, too, history and how it repeats. So the town in the story is where my grandmother lived, a place called Cerro Gordo, named by the men coming home from the Mexican War. A town in Illinois cut in two by the tracks of the Wabash Railroad, where people stood in their yards to watch the Wabash cannonball go through. A novel is a community within the covers of the book. The smaller the town, the more meaningful is every inhabitant, unless that small town is a suburb. Grandma Dowdle isn't the first of the great granite elders to stalk through my pages. There's an elderly character in every one of my books. Uncle Miles in The Ghost Belonged to Me, Madame Malevich in Are You in the House Alone, Polly Pryor in Remembering the Good Times. And very shortly now, in a new book called Fairweather, a gnarled old codger named Granddad Fuller. These ambulatory ancient monuments are there to provide wisdom and balance for a self-referential youth culture. They're there for young readers in age-segregated suburbs and in inner cities where the elderly fear the streets. They're for the young anywhere who can be out on a school night and have thus robbed themselves of their own roots and are once again at the mercy of each other. Most of all, the old survivors in my stories embody the underlying message in all fiction, that in the long run, you will be held responsible for the consequences of your actions. A serious message, and so a comedy is called for. Our readers find their role models and their lawgivers in their peer group leaders. Mary Alice finds hers in an elder, where I found mine. From my father, I learned nostalgia as an art form. My stories are set where he grew up. A paradise lost to him on the battlefields of World War I. Like all soldiers returned, he found the past wasn't where he'd left it. That only fueled his stories of boyhood until they merged in my mind with the stories of Mark Twain. I still see the stories of both these men through the mesh of a sun-warmed screen door in long-vanished, never-ending summer afternoons. I am here this evening because I came from a home where no screens glowed. A home where there were bedtime stories because there was bedtime. I'm here because my mother read to me before I could read for myself. She had no intention of sending an ignoramus to first grade. And so she filled me up with words and opened the door to the alternative universe of storytelling, of fiction. I heard my first stories in my mother's voice. A satisfactory substitute for that technique has yet to be devised. For most of who we are is determined in those first 5 fleeting years of life before we ever see school. The narrative, language itself, is the gift of the elders. We are the elders now, the youngest writers and librarians among us. In only moments from now, a few semesters, our young readers won't be able to remember the 20th century. Powerful forces divorce the young from their roots and traditions. The relentlessness of the video game, the pornography of the prepubescent, a violent virtual reality that eliminates the parent who paid for it. And the more powerful force of the peer group that rushes in to fill the vacuum of the teacher's vanished authority. And an awesome parental power failure. We writers and librarians, we people of the word, spot for survivors in a generation who have learned the wrong lesson from their elementary school years. That yes, you should be able to read and write. Yes, you should be literate. But if you're not, you will be accommodated. Thank you for fighting this good fight. School librarians who know that the beating heart of the school is the library, not the gym. Public librarians who may just be the only adults on call for many of the young. Thank you for stealing time from an increasingly intrusive technology to put the right book in the right young hand. Thank you for standing firm and hanging tough against the book censor, who is so often the parent of a non-reading child. Anyone who has reached this podium has traveled a long trail. Few have traveled a longer one than I have, across 30 years and 30 books. I am not a quick study. It has taken me this long to find the key that unlocks a Newbery. A naked woman and a snake. There is no accounting for taste, and I am grateful to the Newbery Committee for theirs. We read to know we're not alone. That's why we write, too. Thank you for this moment and for everything you will do for the citizens of the 21st century on your first day back on the job.